From Oregon to Mississippi, Wisconsin to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the United States is in global competition with China for dominance in artificial intelligence. The data centers needed to power that competition have become controversial. Taylor Barclay of the Abundance Institute is here to discuss. The Save America Act is Donald Trump's top legislative priority, but the U.S. Senate filibuster rule is standing in the way. What can be done? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Supreme Court of the United States has struck down most of President Trump's tariffs. Are billions in refunds now on the horizon? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And it was the best of states and the worst of states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council looks at the differences between California and Texas on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Data centers are needed to provide the computing capacity to power the artificial intelligence revolution. They are becoming controversial as energy demands escalate. Here to discuss issues related to the development of data centers is Taylor Barclay. He is Director of Federal Government Affairs and a policy advisor at the Abundance Institute. Taylor, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Taylor, we are going to talk about data centers and their importance and various issues related to them. Tell us, first of all, for those who may not know, what is a data center and how does it relate to the overall issue of artificial intelligence?
That is a great question. And but first, Loman, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to talk with you. So data centers are supercomputers. Colleagues and I, we don't really like the term data center because it implies kind of the static, fixed, pretty dull machinery. But they're essentially, when we say data centers now, they're supercomputers, especially in the AI context. So zooming way, way out, when we use our smartphones, even our laptops, a lot of the computing we do, so we're using an app like Uber, for instance, that data is being processed at a computer miles, sometimes hundreds, maybe even thousands of miles away from us at a data center. And a lot of the apps, the services the photos we store, the videos we store on the cloud, that's in a data center somewhere. So everyday life, the things we rely upon to work, to share information and photos with loved ones, that's enabled by data centers. And we're talking about data centers now because AI developments over the last 3 years, so the launch of ChatGPT in late 2022. Really started this revolution in the application of really powerful computers to training AI models and software, and also using AI models and software. And we need these data centers or supercomputers, which are much more powerful, require more energy and more complex computer chips to operate than the data center that is, say, storing our videos and photos or the Netflix and movies we like to stream at night when we're relaxing. But in short, we're having this conversation because of AI developments, the benefits we're getting from AI. But data centers have been around in a really intertwined part of our life for decades at this point.
They have been around for decades, but with the explosion of use of AI here, Taylor, a number of issues have arisen, and we'll talk in a minute about tax policy and things of that sort. But at the local level, as these data centers are being built, because they do require significant amounts of energy, it becomes an issue locally for zoning matters and also the need for the nation to more significantly tap its energy resources. I want to address that component.
I like to start here with the frame because in my experience when talking about data centers, these supercomputers, and terms like 500 megawatts are thrown around and 5 million gallons of water. And these are numbers that I struggled with just because I didn't have a context for it. But to start at the very beginning, prosperity is energy intensive. If we want the American economy to grow in any means, we need to generate and use more electricity. So I think that's where I really like to start. If we're going to see the economic growth go gangbusters in the U.S., we need to use more electricity and also generate that. And now we're at this juncture where these data centers that are being funded by these hyperscaler AI companies. They do require a lot of electricity, but this is kind of like, I think of it as maybe the next industrial revolution. In American history, there was a huge build-out of railroads, and that is what fueled economic growth 150 years ago, and we're kind of a similar moment today. And, you know, I just want to quickly note, the electricity use here, it's doable. It's possible to build that. And I think, President Trump has talked about this through his term and has shown great leadership in lowering regulatory barriers to build out of a new electricity generation sources, speeding up permitting processes, just so the right power generation can be built in time to meet the needs of America. And even setting aside the data center build-out, reindustrialization, bringing factories back to the U.S., restarting manufacturing, that is also very electricity and energy intensive. So even setting aside data centers, we need to build more electricity generation to make it possible. And I'll quickly note, maybe just as some context, I live in Northern Virginia, which is the global epicenter of data center development. We hear a lot about how data centers are leading to rising electricity prices for consumers. But here in Northern Virginia and in Virginia widely, consumer electricity prices, residential electricity prices have gone down, actually, because data centers, they operate on a grid and are, because they're on 24/7, they're a very reliable, predictable source of electricity use for a utility. So utilities, with the help of companies, can make investments in new generation, and that is just a benefit to the consumer overall. So threw a couple things out there, Loman, but hopefully that can help your listeners kind of think through the bigger picture of what's going on here.
Let us talk here for a minute, Taylor, about tax policy. And a lot of times as businesses seek to expand or locate in states, they're given tax incentives and various breaks that somewhat distort the free market. What do you see happening when it comes to tax policy surrounding these data centers?
We at the Abundance Institute have, our message is let the market work. The market forces have been the primary driver of human prosperity throughout human history. And these tax incentives, over the last 10 years or so, were an attractive toolkit for a policymaker, especially, these tech companies, these data center companies. Hey, come to our state, we'll give you a tax break to, build here, because data centers are, they drive a ton of revenue for a state and property tax revenue. And, Loudoun County, Virginia, hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenue. So they're attractive for that in that sense. But we've seen some policymakers lately, because of the public backlash against some of these data center buildouts, policymakers backing off of tax incentives. And to me, that's the right move. Like, we should let the market work here. These companies have the money. They want to invest the money in these localities, and they should be paying taxes like other businesses. Overall, I'm not the biggest fan of tax incentives. Maybe on the margin, they could be helpful here and there, but as a primary tool in the policy kit, they shouldn't be reached for as like the first solution to bringing new investment in an area.
We have been talking with Taylor Barclay of the Abundance Institute. Taylor, tell us a bit about the Abundance Institute.
We are a think tank headquartered in Salt Lake City, Utah, and Abundance Institute, we're a group of public policy researchers who are passionate about ensuring emerging technologies have the chance to bring about their full benefits. Technological progress has been the primary driver of improving quality of human life, education opportunities, human freedom, and we think the future can be even better. So folks who are interested in finding out more, check us out at abundance.institute.
Taylor Barclay of the Abundance Institute. Taylor, as always, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman. Great to be here.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. The big news this week, the maneuvering over the Save America Act, which, Scott, first of all, good to have you here, but that's starting to look like it's becoming a major effort on the part of Republicans, particularly in the U.S. Senate. Want to tell us a bit about what the act is, and then we'll talk about procedurally how we go forward.
The House of Representatives already passed the Save America Act, and what the legislation does is it provides for only U.S. citizens to be able to vote in U.S. elections. You have to have proof of citizenship. And then you also have to have voter ID when you go and vote. Those seem like two pretty common sense things to protect American elections. But you'd be surprised, and I say this facetiously, that the Democrats, of course, want to block this. And the bigger issue is that there's some Republicans in the United States Senate that aren't willing to pull out all the procedural stops to get this thing passed. You've got 50 U.S. Senate sponsors. They're all Republicans. And when you have J.D. Vance in the presiding officer's chair as the president of the Senate, he can always cast tie-breaking votes. But there's what's known as the filibuster today is a requirement that you need 60 votes to end debate when cloture is filed. But the thing is, if you go all the way back into U.S. Senate history, what happened before cloture? Cloture didn't even come about until 1917. And at the time, it was a two-thirds vote majority to file cloture and end debate. And then they amended that to be a three-fifths majority, 60 votes later in the early 1970s. But what happened in that intervening period when, you know, our nation was being founded? How did they actually enforce a filibuster? Well, they actually made senators stand up and talk. And it was known as a talking filibuster. I think that's what a lot of people kind of understand to be a filibuster, even today, if they're familiar with the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington story, or if you've watched Ted Cruz or Rand Paul or even Cory Booker on the Democrat side hold the floor for 18, 20 hours straight on an issue while they talked. Those were sort of political stunts. The issue with the talking filibuster is that the Senate Majority Leader, John Thune, he always has priority recognition on the Senate floor as the leader. And so he would be recognized and he can just move to get on the bill without filing cloture on the motion to proceed. The procedural motion, if you do that, would basically allow for 30 hours of debate before you would have the vote on cloture on the motion to proceed. And then if that passed, you would get on the bill. But the other way to do it is to force this talking filibuster. And John Thune is, I think, concerned about a handful of the moderate Republicans, the rhinos, the uniparty guys that go along to get along, blocking that effort. And I think it's been publicly reported. You've got folks like Lisa Murkowski and Mitch McConnell and maybe Tom Tillis, maybe even Bill Cassidy, maybe Susan Collins, maybe John Curtis from Utah. There's a lot of senators that are sort of hiding in the procedural shadows right now, but there's more and more pressure each and every single day to move forward on the Save America Act. President Trump said during the State of the Union that this was the most important legislative effort that he needed Congress to get done. And we can do this through a show vote. We can do it through fake political theatrics, or we can actually get the bill done by moving to get on the bill, enforcing the talking filibuster, and letting that process play out. Now, when has the talking filibuster last been used to a deal of success? It was used in, I think, 1964 when we did the Civil Rights Act. And at the time, got on the bill through the majority leader, and instead of this bill passing with just 50 votes, they had a real amendment process. They had real debate for a long time, and it ended up passing with 71 votes. And so for those that say it's a fait accompli that the Save America Act is going to fail, I say, why don't we make the Senate actually do their work? Why don't we make them actually get on the bill, open it up for debate, and see what happens? There's always that point of exhaustion. This thing is not going to last for 6 months. I think if it lasted for 6 days, I'd be pretty surprised, because more than anything, senators get grumpy. They get exhausted. They're pretty old. It's almost like the retirement home for politicians, and I think that they would ultimately yield to allowing for a final vote and to make sure that only U.S. citizens can vote in elections and that we have voter ID at the polls.
What is the next step here, Scott? There's been, as you pointed out, a lot of discussion about this. There are a couple of procedural options here. Does it look like anything is likely to happen in the next few days or the next couple of weeks? Because there is, and I'm sure from your travels around the country you've picked up on this, there's a lot of growing grassroots dissatisfaction with the Senate in particular not getting things done.
Great point. If we can't pass an 80-20 issue with our majorities, what are they actually good for? Just these uniparty deals that, you know, we could strike even if the Democrats were in power? We have to use our power, and that starts with John Thune getting on the bill. So what can the listeners today do? You can look up your senator's phone numbers, call their offices, and tell them that you want them to move forward with the talking filibuster and to pass the Save America Act to protect our U.S. elections. I think that there's a growing dissatisfaction with the MAGA America First base that really feels like, what exactly are they doing in Congress? You know, I think there's a lot of people that are really supportive of President Trump. He went through a laundry list of achievements that the Trump administration has accomplished over the first 14 months of his second term. But then there's people that say, well, what exactly has the Congress been doing? Okay, the Senate has passed a bunch of nominations, and yeah, they had to do the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, but what else are they doing?
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization. We've endorsed the Save America Act. If you want to learn more about our work or sign up to become a member of Club for Growth, which you can do for free, you can visit us at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Will the federal government have to refund billions of dollars in tariffs now that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled the law under which they were levied was unconstitutionally applied? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains.
In the days since President Donald Trump's tariffs were struck down by the Supreme Court, administration officials and the president himself have signaled something of an unwillingness to refund hundreds of billions of dollars of what are now illegally collected taxes. And that's despite the fact that the Trump administration told courts and the media last year that it would be both willing and able to issue those refunds in the event that the tariffs were blocked. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Before we get to that, we do have to back up, I guess, just and cover the news. You've probably heard of about this by now, but of course, the Supreme Court did strike down many of the tariffs that Trump levied last year. Not quite all of them, but many of them, the ones that were imposed via the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA, as it's known. Those tariffs included the ones that were imposed on goods from Canada and Mexico and China starting in February of last year. And it also covered the so-called Liberation Day tariffs that were implemented in April, or at least announced in April. Many of them were actually implemented in August after being scaled back quite considerably. Those tariffs generated somewhere around $170 billion in revenue over the course of the past year. And it's now kind of an open question what happens to the businesses that paid those tariff bills. And of course, it was American businesses that were paying those tariff bills because that's how these things work. Now, thousands of companies, including some really big names like FedEx and Costco, have already filed lawsuits seeking refunds of the tariff bills. One of the big nonprofits that was involved in a few of the lawsuits involving these tariffs representing some small businesses, that group, the Liberty Justice Center, is also now engaged in a new lawsuit seeking the tariff refunds. And as I said, at stake here is something like $175 billion in revenue that is sitting in the Treasury right now, that at least by the reading of that Supreme Court decision on Friday was illegally collected. But during a press conference shortly after the Supreme Court's ruling on Friday, Trump indicated that he expects this to be kind of a drawn-out legal battle to get those payments back, saying that the issue might get litigated for the next 2 years. And Trump actually blamed the Supreme Court for not directly addressing the question of the refunds in its ruling. Now, it seems likely that the Supreme Court did not wade into the refund issue because that matter had already pretty much been settled when the tariffs were in front of lower courts. This wasn't really one of the questions, it wasn't at all one of the questions that the Supreme Court was dealing with in that decision. When the Court of International Trade ruled against Trump's tariffs back in May of last year, attorneys from the Trump administration argued against the need for any sort of injunction to block the ongoing collection of the tariffs while the case was being appealed. It was ultimately appealed to a U.S. appellate court for the federal district, and then ultimately, of course, up to the Supreme Court. And after that first ruling in May of last year, attorneys for the administration said that they didn't want to see any sort of injunction from the court because anybody who was harmed by the tariffs could easily be made whole after the fact. The administration said, quote, They'd be able to fully remedy any harms by obtaining a refund of any tariffs ultimately held invalid. They repeated that claim in December, attorneys for the Trump administration, as litigation over that same injunction continued. In December, they told the court that the administration would not oppose or object to the court's authority to order reliquidation of plaintiffs' subject entries of merchandise, meaning the tariff payments, if those payments were ultimately ruled invalid. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent also acknowledged in interviews that tariff refunds would have to be issued if the courts ultimately ruled against the Trump administration. Asked during a September appearance on NBC's Meet the Press, Bessent was pretty unambiguous. He said, if the court says it, we'd have to do it. But after the Supreme Court's ruling, Bessent has backpedaled away from that position. During an appearance on Fox News on Friday, he said this could be a mess. It could take months. It could take years to litigate and get out those payments. Bessent also, much like Trump, accused the Supreme Court of being discombobulated on the refund issue and echoed Trump's surprise about the lack of clarity on that topic. Now, on one hand, I am somewhat sympathetic to the idea that it is complicated to get the refunds back to the right people. And that's because of the way the tariffs work. So when an importer brings in a good that is subject to a tariff, they have to pay that bill. They pay that bill and the money goes to the Treasury. But then the importer passes the cost of that tariff along to maybe the goods are going to a manufacturing firm where they might be raw materials that are turned into something else. That cost follows it all the way through the supply chain, and ultimately it's consumers that pay for the tariff. But when you refund anything like this, you're refunding, of course, the people who made that payment, the importers themselves, whoever brought the goods into the country. And that is a somewhat unsatisfying result here, because it, regardless of how you do this, it won't necessarily make everybody whole for the costs of the tariffs. And I also hope that partisanship doesn't cloud people's judgments about this, because I think conservatives would rightly be just up in arms over this if there had been a Democratic president who had imposed a tax that the Supreme Court then threw out because it was illegal. If the Biden administration had just decided to unilaterally raise corporate income taxes, for example, or unilaterally impose some sort of tax on capital gains above and beyond what's allowed by the laws that Congress has passed, then any money that was collected there would obviously have to be refunded to the people who paid it. And I think that would be something that most conservatives and Republicans would agree with. The same principle should apply here. The bottom line is that the federal government simply shouldn't be allowed to keep billions and billions of illegally collected dollars from American businesses just because it might be complicated or difficult to refund the money. And it certainly shouldn't get away with running that scam after repeatedly telling courts and the public that the refunds would be readily available. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this very important topic and everything else going on around the country this week, including the State of the Union address on Tuesday night. We've got some great coverage of that this week at Reason.com. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
State policies make a big difference as residents flee California and move to Texas and other low-tax states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this American Radio Journal commentary.
This November, Californians may be asked to approve what would be the nation's first wealth tax, a one-time, perhaps, 5% levy on net worth of billionaires. It is presented as a simple matter of fairness, but as with so many political proposals, what is simple in rhetoric becomes very complicated in reality many times. Even before the measure had passed, some of the very people it targets has done what millions of other Californians have already done. They have exited California for a lower tax state with more economic opportunity. Their departure alone could erase a significant amount of the total revenue proponents originally projected from the wealth tax. Politicians often speak as if wealth exists in a vacuum, static and waiting to be tapped. But wealth is dynamic and created by people, and people can move and do move. The idea that you can tax high earners at will without changing their behavior is simply not supported by either economics or experience. Billionaires are merely the most visible example of a much broader trend. Over the last decade, California has experienced a net loss of approximately 2.3 million residents to one of the other 49 states. That exodus is not confined to the ultra-wealthy. Middle-class families, retirees, and small business owners have all been voting with their feet, as we like to say, away from California. The Golden State has natural advantages that most states can only envy. A temperate climate, a vast coastline of incredible beaches, world-renowned industries in entertainment and technology, and cultural influence that spans the globe. Yet despite many of these long-term advantages, California policymakers have managed to create a policy environment so burdensome that millions have concluded they are better off elsewhere. The state levy is the second highest income tax rate on high earners in the country, behind only Oregon. These rates are justified by proponents as necessary to support public services. But while many states have reduced personal income tax rates in the years following the pandemic, California has moved in the opposite direction. Meanwhile, the leading destination for departing Californians has been Texas. The contrast is stark. Texas levies no personal income tax, maintains a low business tax, and continues to reduce taxes and protect right-to-work laws. Even after major tax cuts in Texas, the state has boasted a budget surplus of more than $20 billion at the start of last year, while California has major budget deficits. In the rich states, poor states, Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index, Texas stands near the top, while unsurprisingly, California lingers near the bottom. This divergence is not an accident. Incentives matter. States that penalize productivity and investment should not be surprised when both decline within their borders. The broader fiscal picture tells a similar story. Between 2019 and 2024, California's population declined. Over the same period, state spending, even after being adjusted for inflation, which was hefty during those years, grew by 20%. By contrast, Texas saw its population grow by roughly 8% during those same years. One might assume that such growth would require a commensurate increase in government spending. Yet, adjusted for inflation, Texas actually spent less in 2024 than it did in 2019. Growth in population did not translate into unchecked growth in government in Texas. Per-person spending now is roughly three times in California what it is in Texas. And what are they getting for it? These two state models illustrate a fundamental truth. Americans are free to compare policy regimes not merely in theory, but in practice. They can observe which states generate opportunity and which impose excessive costs. They can assess not only promises, but actual results. And when dissatisfied, they can and do relocate. A wealth tax in California may satisfy a desire to, quote unquote, do something about inequality, but it does nothing to address the deeper structural issues driving residents away. High tax rates, expansive regulation, and spending that rises regardless of effectiveness. Indeed, by signaling that accumulated assets are fair game for extraordinary taxes, it may very well accelerate the very outmigration that has already undermined California's revenue projections and its future. For more information on this, you can go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WENG AM and FM in Englewood, Florida, along with KQEQ AM in Fresno, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.